The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Bonjour, hi, Canada. Hugh Hewitt inside the ReliefFactor.com studio, inside the Beltway on this Wednesday, April the 28th in the year of our Lord 2021. I have a great show coming up today. Washington Post columnist James Homan joins me. Mike Gallagher, Congressman extraordinaire from Wisconsin. Big announcement coming from him this morning. Brian Westbury will be along to look at the markets as they bounce around. Alaska Senator Dan Sullivan. Those will all be included on the morning podcast, Hugh Hewitt Show, Highly Concentrated Hugh, which goes up every day over at Salem Podcast Network, and of course at Apple iTunes, Spotify, and wherever fine podcasts are. Joby Warrick will be along for the last half hour of the show. Joby Warrick is, I think, America's best reporter, and Joby Warrick has written Black Flags. He has written Triple Agent. He has now written Red Line. And Red Line is about the Syrian WMD and some extraordinary books within the book. You'll have to listen. That will be its own podcast at the interview with Hugh Hewitt, also over at Apple iTunes, also over at Spotify and at the Salem Podcast Network. I encourage you to subscribe to both, rate both, leave a comment, tell your friends. Extraordinary growth in both podcasts because America wants content. Speaking of content, let me give you the morning rundown. The CDC, according to the Washington Post, finally said yesterday that fully vaccinated Americans can go without masks outdoors, except in crowded settings. This is up there with the guidance we have previously received from the CDC that the bee, leave the bee alone, the bee won't bother you if you don't bother the bee, and that SPF 30 is fine, SPF 50 may be better, but SPF 100 is really just like wearing a sign saying I'm from Pittsburgh. Really, it was not the world's greatest guidance, because if you didn't already know, you didn't have to wear a mask outdoor if you're vaccinated. I don't know what to do with you. The real news is coming from India. The headline in the Post, coronavirus has crushed India's health system. Patients are on their own. Wow. Patients are on their own. It is a devastating second wave of coronavirus infections, according to the Post. Patients and their families are on their own, fighting to save their loved ones in an overwhelmed system where ambulances, hospital beds, oxygen, medicine, even cremation grounds are in short supply. 300,000 cases a day, nearly 3,000 deaths a day. India's security forces, according to the Financial Times, have been called in to bolster the fight. It's become a warlike situation in the capital, New Delhi, one of the hardest hit cities, and the Indo-Tibetan Border Police reopened an emergency treatment center built during the first wave. So we are rushing supplies from America. That is good. If you're an Indian American and you want to call me and tell me what you've heard, 1-800-520-1234. 1-800-520-1234. I've got a lot of Indian American friends who are out there. I'd love to get first-person accounts if you want to give us a call. On the market side, Google earnings just blew away people's expectations, smashing sale records as the digital ad business boomed. Connected with the reopening of the economy, of course, and they found a lot of people shifting their ad purchases to travel, leisure, and hey, we're open, hey, we're open. So good that Google announced a $50 billion buyback of its own stock, and the stock went up about 5% after market. They don't tell you what it's going to do today. It's just going to have a good day today. Starbucks expects higher profits as customers return. Now, you know what my theory on Starbucks is? If you are a young person and you never go to Starbucks and instead, you know, get Folgers, here we are, every drop of waking up is Folger in your cup, whatever that is. If I had a producer, I'd play the jingle. I drink Folgers. And because I drink Folgers, I've saved, I don't know, $50,000 since Starbucks opened. I think Starbucks is another I'm from Pittsburgh move, but go ahead. You go to Starbucks if you want. More people are. Joe Biden's given a speech tonight. The president's going to call for spending more money than God ever thought we would spend in the United States, and he wants to spend it on everything that you never thought we really needed to buy before, like other people's preschool aid and the child tax credit. The child tax credit expansion is the one thing I like. I like subsidizing children. What you pay for, you get. that which gets rewarded gets repeated. As I told you yesterday, the story that I kept, the only story I kept from yesterday's stack, is about the census. U.S. population over the last decade grew at the slowest rate since the 1930s. Well, the answer to that is simple. Subsidized kids, you'll get more kids. So I'm hoping they take the temporary child tax credit and make it permanent. But we will see. I do not expect to have many highlights of tonight's speech because I don't expect there will be many highlights. President Biden is the nice Pacific, just go along to get along guy that we've been expecting for the post-Trump trauma. Inflicted people never really bothered me, made the morning show pretty easy to do when the president tweeted, and now there's the news world is falling apart. You should see the ratings on television cable because there's just no news because the president takes a golf cart from the helicopter to the White House. I don't know what that's all about. Never seen that before, but I imagine they will airlift him into the Congress tonight, and he'll deliver 30-minute, 45-minute speech, and we will forget it like we forgot every other address to the Congress ever, except Ronald Reagan after he got shot and George W. Bush after we were attacked. Creation of the first human-monkey embryo sparks concern. You think? The Wall Street Journal has this story. They're making human-monkey embryos, and some ethicists are worried. Ethicists? Ethicists? I'm just a little old country lawyer. But I say that because I went to Michigan Law School. And this little old country lawyer says, that's crazy. Shut it down. Real ID requirement for air travel is delayed. Another common sense move. Never really understood why we needed real ID either, on the assumption that most photo IDs were good enough for the last 20 years to avoid air hijacking. But we need real ID because, of course, DMVs are pleasant places to go, and everyone wants to have a chance to go to the DMV and bring, by the way, your Social Security, your birth certificate, and two other proofs of evidence. Otherwise, you're turned away. And at the Virginia DMV, unless Glenn Youngkin wins, we're going to have to come back four or five times to get it. This is of great importance to Dwayne. Did Dwayne come in this morning? Do we have the Dwayne cam up? Is he in there? Because Dwayne, I've been reading the Rick Atkinson book that President Bush recommended last week. Turns out that Generalissimo Washington, when he arrived in Cambridge to take control of the Continental troops, was only called Lissimo. That was his nickname, Lissimo. So I've been calling you Generalissimo all these days, and you're just Lissimo from now on.
But you never named me after him. You named me after Franco.
Well, that's true. He was Generalissimo. But I've got a story for you. This is going to make you happy.
I was going back to the monkey-human hybrid.
No. This is more important. This is from the Wall Street Journal. Track suits like those worn by Run at DMC are back in style. So your whole wardrobe is back, Dwayne.
Yeah.
Track suits are back.
Yeah.
And so go into that. You go get Mrs. Generalissimo and tell her to take those track suits out of mothballs.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, JPM Morgan calls U.S. bankers back from the office beginning in July. Jamie Dimon is a hard-knuckled guy, wants all of his bankers back. So, I mean, that means, Dwayne, you have to come in more than once a year. If Jamie Dimon can make the bankers come in, you've got to come into the studio, too. Meanwhile, our friend Walensky did something right with his life, which is pretty amazing because he's an Eagles fan.
He left Philly.
He left Philly and he went to California, but then he moved up to Coeur d'Alene, Idaho. And it turns out, according to the Wall Street Journal, Coeur d'Alene, Idaho is America's hottest housing market. Now, he went there 2 years ago. Now, I'm not too sure about this because second is Austin, Texas, which makes sense. Third is Springfield, Ohio, which I don't really get, followed by Billings, Montana.
I figured Nashville would be up there, too.
Well, it's not on the list. I'm telling you, it's Coeur d'Alene, number one. Then we've got one of the best stories of the year. Canadian lawmaker apologizes for taking nude photo of colleague. I mean, don't you have to read that story when you see that headline? Now, that is a headline. That's a headline. Adam, you're a Canadian. This is a Canadian story. Canadian lawmaker apologizes for taking nude photo of colleague. So the first question is, why was the colleague nude and where was the colleague nude? The second question is, why would the other Canadian lawmaker take the picture? And of course, the answer is a Zoom call. A Zoom call. Zoom is an evil device that has to be destroyed and removed from our lives. They were doing a Zoom call, and Sebastian Lemire, a member of Bloc Quebec, acknowledged having taken the photo of William Amos, a Liberal Party member from Quebec. Mr. Amos appeared nude on Zoom during a legislative session last week. He apparently did not know that his computer video was on when he changed from his jogging outfit into his work clothes. Big mistake by everyone involved, but you gotta love the Canadians, you hosers. And I really mean you hosers. When we come back, I hope we have some Run DMC going. Don't go anywhere, America. It's the Hugh Hewitt Show.
There was a time a long, long time ago. Chevy's and Levy's.
Welcome back, America. It's Hugh Hewitt. No cell phone. Some people ask me why I open every hour and then play in the first mid-hour break John Andrasik, Five for Fighting. And it's because a radio host doesn't have an audience. They have a bunch of technology around them and a producer in their ear. And if it's Generalissimo, it's a pain in the neck. And they got an engineer like Adam, and they got knuckleheads running the board, and Adam and Harley. But they need a little boost of endorphin, right? So music that you like is the endorphin shot. That's just basic production. And the reason I'm telling you that is I have got a great story of overproduction. Everyone who's ever worked with me, I've been in this business 30 years, on television, on radio, in live events. And I don't believe I've done full-length documentaries and stuff like that, but it doesn't qualify as film. But whether it was my own completely ghastly rated MSNBC show, the lowest rated show in the history of MSNBC, or this show, which is among the top five in the country, or whether it is an auditorium with 2,000 people or a small Zoom meeting of 10, I have one rule, which is the show is the show, meaning don't overproduce. Overproduction is a nightmare. And Dwayne and I have one rule. Everybody is a producer, except the producer. Dwayne is, I hate to do this. I want to compliment him. He's the world's greatest radio producer, and I can prove that to you because Tony Snow, the late, great Tony Snow, tried to steal him from me in a pirate-like move before Tony went to the White House under W and was running a talk show for Fox Talk Network. His first call went to Dwayne, and he tried to lure him away with bags of gold. Wait, he wanted you to move, though, to New York, didn't he? Is that what
not
the
New
deal
York,
breaker
DC,
was?
It would have been D.C.
Yeah, he tried to get you to move to D.C. And I love Tony, and I gave him grief about that forever. But he knows what it... But the rule is, the show is the show, the host is the host, get to the show. And I learned this as an attendee of way too many rock and roll shows. You know, when you're willing to play for anybody at any time, you just pick up the axe and go, you get a lot of exposure to bad production and good production. And the deal is get the undercard on immediately on time. Doesn't matter when the other band shows up. If the show begins on time and it's a good show, what you don't want and you can't have are lots of intros. Now, I've fought the 30 years war with my friends at Salem. We finally have a great guy named Dan Nelson who produces our events. And Dan and I only have one knife fight a year over the intro video. If we go out on the road and I'm traveling with Mike Gallagher and Dennis Prager, those two guys insist on having an 8-minute bio roll about themselves. They really do. They want an 8-minute. Mike was born in Dayton, and he was born in a box, and he didn't have any crayons. And then Dennis Prager speaks 9 languages, and at the age of 4, in a hula hoop on a corner, he would count to 10 in Russian and cake quarters. I mean, their life story. It all comes up. And I'm sitting there in the back waiting. The show is the show is the show. And the perfect example of this, I'll tell Prager's story, is when after her unsuccessful run as vice presidential nominee, Sarah Palin, Prager, and I go to Denver. And it's a big show. It's at University of Denver. And they got 7,000 people there. And Brian is running the show. And Brian is really one of the great general managers, VPs at Salem has. And it's supposed to be a tight, very tight show. 15 minutes for Prager, 15 minutes for Hewitt to let the crowd settle in and go down. And then 45 minutes for Sarah Palin, as much as she wants, followed by the three of us doing questions. That's the show. The show is the show is the show. Well, Dennis Prager has never given a 15-minute speech in his long and distinguished life. Really, he never has. And I looked at the rundown, and I said, this is not going to work. And then at the beginning of the rundown, they had one of those Dennis biopics. Dennis was a skateboarding champion, and but for his Cheeto addiction, would have gone to the World Cup, that sort of stuff. And I look and I say, this is overproduced. And at that point, it's too late. The only time I successfully blew up an overproduced show is when I was doing a gig with Rove, also in Denver, also with Brian, and I saw the pre-rundown. I said, that's all. We had a meeting. I said, that's all gone. Rove and I are going to go with a hot start, a cold start with a hot start, meaning we're going to walk out. Hello, everybody. You know Carl. I'm Hugh. You know me because you listen to my radio show. Carl, let's talk about your book. Great success. Well, that Prager event at University of Denver, this all got a point, by the way. I have a story to tell you about Anthony Hopkins and producers. And may they fire everyone connected with the Oscars. And God love you. I know you have families. You'll find work elsewhere. Just never let you near the Oscars again because you overproduced yourself into a nightmare based on facts not in evidence, based upon assumptions that had no basis, based upon hunches, based upon stupid decisions contra to everything else. Everyone has built up a resistance to Oscars going on forever. That's not the problem. The problem is that producers got involved and they thought they knew better than every other producer who's produced the show. And when I run into a local GM or a new person who thinks they know Hewitt better than Hewitt knows Hewitt, I just say, you know, I've been doing this for 30 years. So in Denver, contra to my advice, they go, okay, long intro, endless Dennis Prager toured the world and his lecture on Antarctica video. And that is true, by the way. He's lectured on every continent. Why it's relevant, I've never understood, but it's true. And it goes, that thing plays, and then my thing plays, Hugh Hewitt's from Ohio, and then Sarah, it's all on tape, right? So everybody knows who's on the show, but they insist on playing it. Then they have the sponsor role, and they got to name every construction company in town that has ever bought an ad on my show. And you know, they really don't care either. They just want to sell their thing in the back of the room. They want to have a booth, and they like it when I give them shout-out on the radio and that sort of stuff. They don't care about being in the video. And then finally, Prager rolls out, and he's got a bad back, so he's in a wheelchair. So it takes him a while to wheel up, and then he lumbers in. It's like FDR walking to accept the nomination for president in 32. And, you know, he lumbers up to the stage. And Dennis, honest to goodness, I love Dennis. And we have a dear, dear friendship. He goes 40 minutes. So he goes 40 minutes. So he's blown through his time, my time, and 10 minutes of Sarah Palin's time. So Hugh comes up and says, ladies and gentlemen, Sarah Palin. Because the show is the show is the show. And the show that night is Sarah Palin. Well, the show on Oscar night is the Oscars and Best Picture. We have it. We have it down. Now, I didn't watch a minute of it because I knew it would be a goofy thing. And they're surprised. And there's a great story inside Anthony Hopkins' unexpected win at the Oscars over at the New York Times. Kyle Buchanan is their film critic. He's pretty good, the projectionist. And the father won for Best Actor. Anthony Hopkins won. Now, if Anthony Hopkins said, you know, I'm 83 years old. I really don't want to come to L.A. for this. And I really don't want to go to a special studio that you built. I'm 83. There's a pandemic on. Why don't we do this by Zoom? And the producers puffed up and they said, no, Anthony Hopkins. No, you're Anthony Hopkins, but we are a no-name producer that nobody knows who we are. And we're in charge of this doggone show. And you will either show up or you're not going to be on. We're not doing it. He said, okay, fine. As you like it, I won't do it. I won't be there. And nobody cared because the producers were absolutely certain that Chadwick Boseman was going to win posthumously for his role in Ma Rainey's Black Bottom, a film I still don't know what it's about, and I don't know why he got the nomination, and so I will go see it eventually. I don't know what The Father's about other than dementia, and I will go see it eventually. I wanted to go see Best Movie nominees in the theater. So what happens? They don't have Anthony Hopkins because they threw down on a legend. And the legend said, well, you know, I don't really need to do this. It's sort of like Marlon Brando sending his Native American friend to say, no, thanks, I don't want your Oscar. And Anthony Hopkins, but he's very polite. He's been in recovery like for 40 years, and he's very polite, man, very grateful to be alive. And so there's this whole story is about why they won, when the story should be about the crazy surprise winner, Anthony Hopkins, not being there, and why did the producers not let him use Zoom? That's the real story. But, of course, Kyle Buchanan can't write that because then he'll never get another interview in the rest of his life in Hollywood. So he can't really write the big boneheaded move, which is everybody's a producer, but most of them are no doggone good. Dwayne, can we agree on something? Can we agree that everybody is a producer, but most of them are no doggone good?
Yes. I have always said that people have two things that they know in life. Whatever they do for a living... and how to produce a radio show.
I know. I've almost had coffee. You can't say that line because I had coffee. I was about to snort it. Now, Salem has some great producers. Gallagher's producers. What's Gallagher's producer's name?
I don't think anybody knows who his producer's name is.
Come on. What's his name?
You mean Hanson?
Hanson. Yeah, Eric. And he's a good producer, right? And our substitute producer in New York who loves Bruno Mars. What's his name?
Sam Boland.
Yeah, he's Matt. Yeah, we call him Sam. Remember Matt? I wonder how the anniversary presents are going.
Yeah.
Is he married? Do we know if he's still married? Matt, are you still married? The guy got his wife a Bruno Mars ticket a year in advance and said, happy anniversary. I said, you're not going to be married very long, buddy. And it was on the floor.
Oh, I'm sure he's still
married. She's like 5'4".
I'm sure he's still married. They may have an extra bedroom in their apartment.
I'll tell you, that was one of my favorite mornings, educating a young man on his first anniversary present. He bought his wife a ticket on the floor to a Bruno Mars concert in a year, and she's 5'4" on the floor. I mean, that we're not allowed to play Bruno Mars anymore.
For like 6 months down the road, too.
Yeah,
I'll gladly buy you a concert.
Tuesday. She could have stood on the chair, and she still wouldn't have seen anything. But there are good producers everywhere. Prager's producer, Alan, is one of the greatest producers in the world. And someday he's going to smile.
Nice.
Someday he's going to smile, do you think?
Nice man. There's nothing wrong with him that a personality implant won't fix.
No, we're going to see him smile someday, and I'm going to be happy. And then you got great engineers. Adam just said 2 minutes in my head, and so we got great producers. But the show is the show. And this rant is to everybody out there, whether you're running community theater or the eighth grade play, or you're going to reopen Broadway in 6 months, or you get the Oscars next year. The show is the show. Don't screw around with the show. At the Nixon Library, where I've been in charge for a couple of years, the one thing we changed, no more Voice of God stuff, no more big drum rolls. If Jim Mattis is here, people are here to see General Mattis. Get him onto the stage as quickly as you can. And Hewitt asks short questions, right? Because the show is the show.
You don't everybody have to reinvent the wheel every time.
Just write that down. The show is the show. And I will go. It's on my tombstone, except I won't have one. Hugh Hewitt, the show is the show. Speaking of which, this show is ReliefFactor.com.
Actually, there's your tombstone.
Yeah, Relief Factor, brought to you by ReliefFactor.com. But it's going to have 100 years on it, 100 plus years, because I take this ReliefFactor.com and I do the 16-8 fast, and I feel great. 6 miles yesterday. I carry curcumin, resveratrol, and omega, the only supplement I take. Although I'm thinking about there might be one more out there. I might have to take a protein supplement. You know, when you turn 65, you start to read this stuff. And thank goodness I was taking Relief Factor for 10 years because I've been doing this right. I'll tell you what. I can't figure out Medicare to save my life. I really cannot figure out. I don't know how people. I got a JD from Michigan, order of the coif, confirmed by the United States Senate, 30 years on the air, and I cannot figure out Medicare. But I can take ReliefFactor.com so I have enough years to figure out Medicare. That's the good news. Go get it. $19.95, 3-week starter pack.
You still can't figure out a toaster.
No, toasters and Medicare are beyond me. The toasters are out of the house. They're considered too dangerous for me. Stay tuned, America. Welcome back, America. It's Hugh Hewitt, joined by Congressman Mike Gallagher, Republican from the 1st District in Wisconsin. Good morning, Mike Gallagher. How are you, Congressman?
Good morning, Hugh. We got the Brewers at the top of the NL Central. Life is good, my friend.
Well, I understand there is an argument over the Upper Peninsula into which you waded yesterday. Apparently, somebody at the Census Bureau believes that the Upper Peninsula belongs to Wisconsin.
Well, Hugh, Ohio actually figures quite prominently into this story. If my history is correct, the UP used to belong to the territory of Wisconsin, and it was unjustly robbed from Wisconsin owing to a land dispute between Michigan and Ohio over Toledo. So as I said when I ran for the first time in 2016, I intend to take it back and make Wisconsin bigger again?
Well, Congressman, with all due respect, anybody who follows Big Ten football knows that The Ohio State University owns both states. So it really doesn't matter what the designation is, because that's just the bottom line.
Oh, Hugh.
Let's get to the important stuff, can we? It's the Shipyard Act. I read the brief on this. The embargo came off this morning about a half an hour ago or an hour and a half ago. I'm very excited about this. I mean, I genuinely am very excited about this. Looks like there's bipartisan support. Looks like it should and will pass. Tell people about it.
Well, despite all the ways the Biden administration wants to expand and redefine the meaning of infrastructure, it seems one critical component is missing, and that's shipyards. During World War II, for example, the U.S. had 10 large Navy yards with dry docks and repair facilities, supported by over 40 commercial dry docks. But today, the U.S. has only 4 public Navy shipyards, 20 commercial repair yards, and 7 major new construction yards, like the one in Marinette, Wisconsin, very close to the UP. These numbers provide context to a recent GAO report that asserted Navy readiness has decreased since 2017, pointing to limited maintenance capacity at private and public shipyards as the primary challenge for recovering ships and sub-readiness. So we have a stark lack of shipbuilding infrastructure. Our capacity has undermined our Navy's ability to meet its Battle Force 2045 goal, which, frankly, I think needs to be more like Battle Force 2025, given the expanding threat from the PLA Navy. Just look at how, while we've been talking about building a 355-ship Navy, the Chinese went out and built the darn thing. So to address this problem, I'm introducing the Shipyard Act. It's a bicameral bill that appropriates $25 billion to improve Navy shipyard infrastructure. This includes $21 billion for public shipyards, $2 billion more for private new construction shipyards, and $2 billion for repair shipyards to modernize facilities and make critical capital equipment improvements. That $21 billion would fully fund the Navy shipyard infrastructure optimization program, and by funding that, the Navy can then accelerate improvements we need to our 4 public shipyards rather than delay upgrades over the next 20-year timeline. You know, it's my belief, Hugh, that any delay will exacerbate existing maintenance shortfalls, negatively impacting current warfighting readiness. We're going to have more ships running into other ships. We're going to have less of an ability to deter the PLA Navy on a day-to-day basis in the Indo-Pacific. And that $2 billion investment in private shipyards, the lifeblood of our Navy, will help subsidize key upgrade and modernization projects that will ensure those shipyards can continue to meet the demands of today and the demands of future. So a critical investment in actual infrastructure that is related to our national defense, and it's time we act with a sense of urgency.
I think this is going to pass because it needs to pass. It's like having airplanes without landing strips. They're no damn good unless you can land the plane. Well, you can't build a ship unless you can build it, and you cannot repair it unless there's a place to repair it, and that's what this does. I believe you have bipartisan support and bicameral support. Who are the Democrats who are aligned with you on this?
Well, in the Senate, we have Senator Tim Kaine and Jeanne Shaheen, and then we have my good friend and independent from Maine, Angus King, who cares deeply about shipbuilding. We got some work to do in the House. I think right now it's just me and Congressman Whitman, but we're hoping we get some Navy-minded Democrats like Elaine Luria and some others. So we're going to be making the case. We got a lot of work to do, but I'm optimistic we can get this passed. You know, those, particularly with those members who have a strong history of supporting the Navy, you know, either because their district houses Navy shipyards or they support the Navy through commercial shipbuilding and repair yards. If you have something like that in your state or your district, you not only see the immediate effect of the shipyard itself and the workforce that goes into the gates every day, but all the downstream effects, just the hundreds of businesses, you know, subcomponent suppliers that depend on a healthy defense shipbuilding industrial base, and also the investments the shipbuilding entities, the shipyards have made in local technical and vocational colleges. That's what's been really remarkable here in Northeast Wisconsin, that symbiotic partnership between Northeast Wisconsin Technical College and Fink and Terry Marinette Marine, where they're training the next generation of workers that are going to go into the gates of that shipyard. And those guys and gals are going to be making a really good wage, building something really cool for the United States Navy. Those are exactly the type of jobs that we need to keep here in America and in the industrial Midwest.
Now, I look at the practical politics. On the House side, you got NASCA, General Dynamics in California. So you're going to pick up a couple of House members there on the Democratic side very, very quickly. But the biggest impediment to anything bipartisan is 60 in the Senate. And you've got two Republican senators in Alabama, two in Florida, two in Mississippi, two in South Carolina, one in Wisconsin, and one in Maine. You've got 10 Republicans to get to 60 right away. Boom, done, done. My only problem with this, Congressman, is it's not big enough. And that if I were the king of the forest, not queen, not duke, not earl, I would triple it and block grant an endowment to the other states of $1 billion or $2 billion each so that they could all have money for the industrial supply chain using the interest from that endowment every year to make industrial supply-based infrastructure improvements and then bring everybody, get something in the bag of goodies so everyone who doesn't have a shipyard doesn't say, hey, in Iowa, we don't have any waterfront, which is true, but it's beside the point because the U.S. Navy protects everybody and we need this. I think you get your 60, you get your majority, a healthy majority, once you sell this thing. My question is timing, because time is of the essence for the reason you just mentioned, the PLAN. When does it actually get marked up? When do you get it to a committee? When does it move?
Well, Hugh, for the Iowans who are skeptical, I'm open to some creative corn-based or ethanol-fueled autonomous shift that can be built there. I mean, we just got to think outside the box here, Hugh. Well, the timing right now, I don't know exactly when we're going to be able to get it moving through the Senate. It probably needs to move through there first. But however, Hugh, here's where there might be an opportunity to think a little bigger. We know this week the Senate's going to start to mark up the China bill, right, which is a combination of the Endless Frontiers Act, which is a massive increase in federal R&D investments in critical technology, as well as funding of the CHIPS Act. The CHIPS Act is basically an effort to incentivize domestic manufacturing of semiconductors, which are critical not only to cars, but also to advanced weapon systems. And really the reason that Taiwan occupies such a place of strategic importance, not because of its historical importance to the CCP, but because the world's leading semiconductor manufacturer, TSMC, is in Taiwan. And therefore, if she effectuates the unification of Taiwan with the mainland by force or by economic coercion, he can hold the rest of the world at hostage. So it's critical we diversify our chip supply chain. If you add this to that effort as a counter-China effort, the price tag for the bill gets a little bit higher for sure, but I think you can retain that bipartisan over 60-vote majority you might need to get it passed in the Senate quite quickly, because I do think there's a lot of bipartisan support for the idea that we are not winning this new Cold War with China right now, and we're getting lapped right now, and we're going to have to make some critical investments in the future. And at a time when the Democrats are spending upwards of $10 trillion, largely on extraneous, non-defense, non-national security-related investments, I got to believe we could carve out, $200 billion for the technology and the defense industrial base that will allow us to survive and thrive going forward in the future.
That we're hosing the country down with money, and I'm hopeful Ron Klain is driving, and he's probably already at the White House right now, and listening, and realize Jerry Hendricks, the retired captain who wrote, and our friend who wrote in the Wall Street Journal about shipyards, this is a blue-red issue. Everybody wins. Stick it in the speech tonight, because everybody, both sides will stand up and say, "Yoo-ha, way to go." And by the way, I'm very glad you got Florida money here. So that means we got the two Republican senators in Florida. It also means that when it gets close and we got to push it over the goal line, they will stay to the end of the game, unlike the Wisconsin representatives who will trot off the field. Scott and Rubio will push this over like the Tampa Bay Buccaneers. They'll play the whole game. They'll get it done. And so I'm glad you got it started, but we got to play the whole game through, Congressman.
How dare you, Hugh? Hugh, I won't dignify that with a response, but I will say this. I always remember when during one of the State of the Unions during President Trump's tenure, he talked about infrastructure. And he basically articulated the concept that we want to make an investment in infrastructure, but we're going to pair it with regulatory reform. So we collapse that 10 years it takes to get infrastructure projects approved to 1 year or 2 years at most. That got a standing ovation. And my recollection was that that was a bipartisan standing ovation. So you want to talk about a smart investment in infrastructure beyond prioritizing shipyards. Let's pair an investment in federal funds with a smart, common sense, deregulatory effort so that it's not, every infrastructure project in the United States isn't the most expensive infrastructure in the infrastructure project in the advanced world. That, to me, is the grand bargain that the Biden administration is not talking about right now. Instead, they just want to waste billions and billions of dollars on non-infrastructure projects. And that just is not a bipartisan approach. And I don't think that's going anywhere.
Last question. Congresswoman Luria and other Democrats who are going to be redistricted and jammed, right? They're going to be jammed in the upcoming 2022 election. They need to be strong on defense. They need this. Do any of them in the bipartisan defense community recognize that they need this? They've got to just stop spraying the country down with money and make it work for the country's national defense?
I think behind closed doors, they would admit that, but they would also say something behind closed doors that they won't say in public, which is that they are afraid. They're afraid of the energy on the far left of the party. They seem to have granted AOC and the squad a de facto veto over all policy. And now the Biden administration, which campaigned on unifying the country, healing the country, bringing back the days of bipartisanship, is crowing and bragging about an agenda that's transformative from a progressive standpoint as FDR. But when you dig into some of these policies, I don't think they're even progressive on their own terms. They're highly regressive. They would bring us backwards. We seem to be advancing backwards, particularly when it comes to education, both in terms of our actual educational attainment, but some of the destructive identity politics ideology we're brainwashing our kids with. And so this is really a concerning time here right now. My hope is that the old blue dog Democrats can reemerge and start to push back on the regressive caucus, because that's not what the American people want. I don't know how you can interpret the election as a mandate for highly regressive change.
You can't, but you can see in there a mandate for the Shipyard Act. I mean, you really can't. It's great jobs. They are craftsman jobs. They may be union jobs. They are all over the United States, and they're critical to the national defense. The Shipyard Act is a big breakthrough. Congratulations on co-sponsoring it and writing it. Mike Gallagher, I know that you have had your heart and soul in it, and the day for the Navalis has arrived. Good luck with that. Glory, America. Bonjour. Hi, Canada. Hugh Hewitt. Joined by United States Senator Dan Sullivan, one of our favorite guests. Now, Alaska does not have an NFL team, so Senator Sullivan rightly, in God's good order, roots for the Browns. The draft is tomorrow night. Congress, Senator, who do you want the Brownies to pick?
Well, you know, Hugh, for the longest time, we needed a franchise quarterback, right? But I think, wouldn't you agree? I think we have one. Finally?
Well, Jimmy Haslam this morning said he will get the long-term extension. Baker will. It's just up to Andrew Berry to figure out when. So I am very confident he's going to be our quarterback for 15 years.
So I think that's the number one issue, right? We've been looking for a franchise quarterback since Bernie Kosar. And, you know, I think picking up somebody, particularly on the defensive line, could still be helpful. But I have not focused exactly on the individuals. I just like the fact that the Browns have now settled on a franchise quarterback.
I'm with you.
Most important thing.
There's a great DT out of Alabama who may fall to us, but I'd like a cornerback. We can come back to that. Senator, you're on Armed Services. I want to talk to you about John Kerry, but first, the Biden administration has sent up a nominee for the Army and a nominee for the Air Force. You do not yet have a naval secretary up there, and we are losing the war at sea with China, the competition at sea at China. What is the deal? Why do we not have a secretary for the Navy nominated by Team Biden? Is it not a priority for them?
Well, look, they need to get moving on that. Unlike, when President Trump was in office and the Democrats tried to block and delay everybody on the DOD side, you know, at this point during the Trump administration, there was only Mattis confirmed. Right now, Biden has his secretary, deputy secretary, and unfortunately yesterday his undersecretary. I went to the floor and spoke very much against the Undersecretary of Defense that was confirmed last night. But we will take whoever they put forward, scrub them, and make sure that they're going to do what we think is in America's national interest. But you're right, Hugh, the Secretary of the Navy, hugely important. Ken Braithwaite, Trump's last secretary, was very good. Secretary Spencer was very good. So we've had two good secretaries of the Navy. But we need one soon, especially with what's going on in China. And by the way, we'll get to it. John Kerry set us back years on the South China Sea when he was Secretary of State, as you probably know, was totally against doing freedom of navigation operations. And argued strongly against that during the Obama years. Why? Because he thought it would hurt China's feelings and they might leave the Paris Climate Accords. That is not a joke. That's a true story. We didn't do FONOPS for over 2 years because of that guy.
I'm coming up to talk to Joby Warwick about his excellent must-read new book, Red Line, Senator. If you haven't read it, as a Marine, former intel officer in the United States Marine Corps, no former Marines, but used to do intel and you know your way around Syria and Iraq and that area, you're going to love Red Line by Joby Warwick, and the Kerry role in that is not very good either. Let me play for you to begin our conversation about John Kerry, and good news on the Navy Sec. I hope you get that. You push your Dem colleagues to get a navalist in there and building because we're falling behind. I mean, way behind. The 2 years ago, Secretary Kerry came on this show. We had a nice conversation. We have a lot in common, a lot of friends in common. And he wrote a memoir. I may be the only person in America that read every page. I asked him this, and we had this exchange 2 years ago.
Okay. It's been reported you've met with him a couple of times, at least since leaving office as well.
Yes, so I have. Still, that's accurate.
Is it a half dozen times, a dozen times?
No. I've met with him at a conference in Norway. I think I saw him in a conference in Munich and at the World Economic Forum. So I've probably seen him three or four times.
Are you trying to coach him through the Trump administration's rejection of the JCPOA?
No, that's not my job, and my coaching him would not. You know, that's not how it works. What I have done is tried to elicit from him what Iran might be willing to do in order to change the dynamic of the Middle East for the better. You know, how does one resolve Yemen? What do you do to try to get peace in Syria? I mean, those are the things that really are preoccupying because those are the impediments.
All right, so that's enough. Senator Sullivan, the entire hour of my conversation with John Kerry is posted at my podcast, The Interview with Hugh Hewitt. But we're talking about Iranian Foreign Minister Javad Zarif. And it turns out that the New York Times leaked to Iran International, a Persian television channel, a long interview with that foreign minister in which he reveals that John Kerry told him Israel had attacked Iranian targets in Syria, you know, dozens, if not 100 times. What did you make of that leak? What did you make of Zarif's comments? I saw your speech on the Senate. Just fill us in on your view of this.
Well, look, even the interview that he did with you, personally, it makes me sick. And here's why. We're not talking about the foreign minister of Canada here. We're talking about the foreign minister of the world's largest state sponsor of terrorism. And, Hugh, the one issue that for 6 years in my first term as U.S. senator I tried to bring to the floor all the time, these guys, Zarif, Soleimani, have the blood of American service members on their hands. With their sophisticated IEDs that they gave to the Iraqi Shia militias, they killed and wounded over 2,000 Americans, our best and brightest. So this is a killer and a terrorist. I went to the Senate floor Monday as soon as I saw that New York Times report and demanded his resignation or for him to be fired by Biden if these allegations are true. And look, I think they're true. As he said to you, he met with Zarif many times. What the hell is he doing meeting with Zarif many times? In 2018, he was clearly trying to undermine President Trump's diplomacy in the Middle East, which has worked out so well with the Abraham Accords. Zarif even said he was, quote, astonished that Kerry would reveal what is secret information about one of our most important allies in the world, Israel, in helping give a leg up to certainly our biggest enemy in the world, in my view, Iran, given their history. So I've asked for an investigation. But I have said, and trust me, there's a lot of senators that are following my lead. If this is true, he needs to resign or be fired. Right now, the guy is a member of Biden's National Security Council, so he's got to go.
Senator, I do not know if Secretary Kerry is obliged to appear before any panel of the Senate, because while he has, I am told, offices in the West Wing, the State Department, and the Pentagon in an unprecedented triple play of authority. I really believe he's sort of the de facto president with the most juice in the room whenever he shows up, because I don't think President Biden particularly has the energy to do this job, but we'll see tonight. Nevertheless, I don't think he is liable to be summoned, is he? He doesn't appear anywhere because he got a West Wing office.
He's not, and remember, he was not confirmed by the U.S. Senate for any of these positions, so that's another reason it's hard to summon him. I have in my, trust me, I'm talking to all my Senate colleagues about this. Even a couple of Democrat senators have said, look, we got to get to the bottom of this, but we're going to keep the pressure on this issue. It is, you know, Zarif said he was astonished. I was astonished. I think John Kerry was probably our country's worst Secretary of State ever, the grand appeaser of Iran. As I mentioned at the top of the show, you know, we were pressing our Navy, our Department of Defense, to do freedom of navigation operations when Xi Jinping was starting to build up the South China Sea reefs. We didn't do that. The reason, I found out later, was in principals meetings, John Kerry was the number one a proponent of not doing anything because he thought it would tick off the Chinese and they might pull out of their Paris climate commitments, which are decades in the future. You can't make this stuff up, Hugh. He and I'll tell you one other thing. Our adversaries, whether it's Iran or China, when they see him out on the world stage, it gives them pleasure. Why? Because they know they can use him to his advantage. Kerry was just in Beijing. And our allies don't trust him. But here's
we've got a minute, Senator. I want to ask you a key question. Those 2,000 Americans killed or wounded, have any of them sought to sue the Islamic Republic of Iran in the way that the parents of the deceased hostage in Korea won a massive judgment against that regime, which has no assets? If these Americans who are injured by Iranian IEDs sue, I believe there are assets to seize. Has that happened, do you know?
I do not know if that has happened, but I think it would be a good idea. And I'll tell you this, you know, one of the things that we did, our great military, the Trump administration, when we killed Soleimani, is that we reestablished deterrence in the Middle East with regard to Iran. You know how hard that is to do, Hugh. We said, hey, if you kill Americans, guess what? You're going to pay a high price. We had not done that in years. And that's one of the many reasons why taking that guy out was so important.
Zarif himself said that in the interview that was leaked. It was a strategic blow to the Islamic Republic. Senator Dan Sullivan, follow him on Twitter at @SenDanSullivan. Always a pleasure to talk with you, Senator. Don't go anywhere, America. I'll be right back on the Hugh Hewitt Show.